Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Kenshiro Uki, who is the general manager of Sun Noodle, a ramen noodle company in New Jersey, and headquartered in Hawaii, and the co-founder of Ramen Lab, which is a test kitchen and a tasting room for talented ramen chefs and ramen lovers. And his achievement was recognized many times, including 30 Under 30 by Zagat, as a rock star redefining the food industry in 2014. Before we start, I'd like to talk about the little sensational news regarding raw fish. According to the New York Times, on July 10th, the New York City Department of Health will require that fish served raw, undercooked, or marinated raw in dishes like ceviche, crudo, and of course sushi must be previously frozen to guard against parasites. And the regulations will take effect this August. A lot of people seem to have reacted negatively to this new rule, so I did a little research to see if it's a good rule or not. And of course, it's good that the government is trying to keep us safe, but the issue here is whether you can simply rely on freezing as a solution to food poisoning from raw fish. So I asked a few questions. No, I asked a few people in the industry for their opinions. And first, Chef Sotohiro Kosugi, who is the owner of the two-star Michelin restaurant Soto in West Village, said freezing fish would work to avoid parasite poisoning, but I'm more concerned about contamination of fish during defrosting. Once the cell walls and tissues of fish are damaged during defrosting, they can easily become a nest of various bacteria. Based on my experience, I would say the risk of parasite poisoning in raw fish is only around 0.5%. I'm not sure which risk is higher, parasite or other bacteria from defrosting. I think he's got a point. Also, freezing does not kill bacteria, such as very dangerous listeria, which needs to be heated at least 140 degrees Fahrenheit to be killed. And of course, freezing affects the taste of fish. Chef Yukihiro Kawaguchi of Oya, New York City, said currently we freeze only salmon because we don't want to lose texture, flavor, taste, nutrition of unfrozen fish, so I'm very disappointed by the new rule. However, freezing may be necessary because Mr. Kazuto Kogawa, an experienced fishmonger at Nishimaru USA, which sells fish to notable restaurants such as Sushi Nakazawa, said the distribution system of fish in this country is very different from that in Japan. For instance, American distributors use 50-pound fish container filled with loads of ice. As a result, fish in the bottom is almost always damaged. On the other hand, in Japan, each fish is packed in a separate container that fits the size of the fish, so there's no damage, therefore much lower risk of food poisoning. We cannot change the distribution system overnight, so unfortunately, my conclusion here is that the new regulations are necessary, but not the best solution at all. Listeners, if you have any comments, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org, and I'd like to hear from you. Now, let's talk about ramen noodles with Kenshiro Uki of Sun Noodles. Hello and welcome to the show.
Hi, welcome.
So, your family owns and operates the ramen noodle company Sun Noodle, and I believe the current ramen boom in New York City would not have existed without Sun Noodle. So, Can you tell us about your company first?
Well, yes. Sun Noodle was established in Honolulu, Hawaii by my father and my mother, Hidehito and Keiko Uki, with the simple, I think, purpose of just trying to supply restaurants with fresh noodles. In Hawaii, we make not just ramen noodles, but since there's a large population of other Asian ethnicities, we supply Chinese restaurants, Filipino restaurants, and all sorts of different noodles. But our main goal is, or our main business is to manufacture noodles, and specifically ramen noodles.
Right. And your father came from Japan, and his family had a noodle company already.
Yes, yes. My father is from Tochigi, Japan, and my grandfather also had a ramen, soba, and udon factory.
Wow, yes. Cool. So, and then you have now three factories?
Yes, here in the States we do have three.
Okay, and you have some other factories?
No, three factories here in the States, and then the ramen lab retail store.
Right, it's okay. And then according to your website, your company manufactures 90,000 servings of ramen a day.
Every day,
that's
yes.
That's a lot of ramen.
Well, sometimes you just wonder, like, how, like, who eats all this noodles? But, you know, we make and then it sells, and so we're very fortunate.
Right. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Right. And your company is known for customized ramen noodles for each client.
Yes.
And it sounds nice, but it'd be much easier if, you know, you just make one type of good noodle.
Exactly.
Yeah. And then sell to all. Mm-hmm. So why do you customize?
Well... You know, when my father started in this industry about 35 years ago, I think for the majority of other manufacturers, it was, you know, one type of noodle or two types, because from a manufacturing standpoint, that's the way to do efficiency. Mm-hmm. So how could my father enter a market that was dominated? He had to really change up his business plan.
Okay.
And so that was, for him, going to each chef and speaking to them and then crafting a noodle that matches their soup. And then every shop he would go and do that. And then, you know, 35 years later, we have a bunch of ramen shops, and they all have different styles of noodles to match what they do. Yes.
Right. So, and you were born and raised in Hawaii.
Yes.
Right. And then did you start working for the company right after you graduated from college?
So, like any other family business, we're all involved. My mother is one of the, you know, We joke and say that, you know, she's really the one that pushes my father. So she's in there working hard. My sister and I, when we were growing up, summer breaks after school, we'd be in the factory packaging. My sister would do a lot of office work. I'd do delivery. So that was kind of our youth. And after college is when we started to really enter the business. And so, I went to school in Washington and then went straight to our California operations.
Okay.
Yes.
Great. And then you moved to New Jersey in 2012 to open the New Jersey factory.
Exactly. A lot of more sales activity, trying to meet with the customers and at the same time building a small little factory.
Right. And then did you expect the ramen was going to be this popular when you joined the company?
No, right now, it just seems like ramen is really trendy. A lot of young professionals tend to enjoy what we do. But when we were growing up, it was nothing cool or anything hip.
Right.
So my sister and I really love where it's become today.
Mm, right. You know? I think the majority of Japanese people in Japan, too, you never expect that ramen could be a keyword or hipsters and something like that.
Yeah.
Right. But why do you think that ramen has become so popular in New York and probably all over the world or country or is that you name it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, if you take a look at where ramen is popular the past 5 years, you could say LA, San Francisco, and New York City. I think, there's many parts to, I think, why. One, just ramen in general is a real comfort food. It's really delicious, and it's affordable. And so anyone can afford a bowl of ramen. But I think especially here in New York City, where you have people who are so into food, interested in food, not just Japanese or Italian, but just all sorts of food, that we have a population that will go and travel and learn more about and try different styles of food. Mm-hmm. And on the other side, you have just really talented chefs and cooks who can take from their experience and really showcase what they want to do in a bowl of ramen. And so it's really exciting. You have high quality ramen here. You have people who want it and appreciate it. And at the end of the day, it's affordable.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing. American chefs started to have very interesting ramen shops. And
yes.
So much creativity with it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. And who are your clients right now?
In New York or?
From New York. So that I think a lot of our listeners can recognize the names.
Some of the ramen shops that we're so fortunate to work with, even before we opened our factory here, Momofuku and their team have been really supportive of us coming out.
Well, actually,
here.
The Momofuku is, the David Chang, who is now a superstar chef, but that was his place, the first restaurant.
Yes,
right?
Yes, his noodle bar.
Right. And it opened 2004, I think.
Exactly,
right.
Yeah. We didn't start working with them until 2008, but again, just really fortunate to work with Momofuku Group. And then, so before I came here, there were a lot of ramen shops owned by Japanese chefs. Mm. So like Setagaya, Takumi, and all these Japanese restaurants that are still here today and do very well.
Right. They used to serve Japanese expatriates.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then they all gone after the recession, and then people started to have the ramen, like American people started to enjoy it. Right.
Personally, for me, when I moved here, end of 2011, 2012, I really got to start working with Chuko in Brooklyn.
Mm.
And
Jameson
Blankenship and Dave. And
he used to be working for Morimoto.
Morimoto, right. Yeah. And I think I was 24 at the time, and they've taught me a lot. And so, Chuko, Ganso in Brooklyn now. Mm.
I talk to you in terms of business or what chefs look for.
Yeah, because for them, they've never operated a ramen shop before, but they're very, very highly skilled chefs.
Okay.
And so learning more about food and different styles and speaking about food was something I've learned from them. And then from there, we've just been very fortunate with people like Totto Ramen, Hide-chan Ramen, and many more in the city.
Right. Yeah, that sounds like you have all the leaders of ramen in this city. Right. And in terms of retail, you have Whole Foods here?
Yes. For the past 5 years, in most Japanese markets, Mitsuwa in New Jersey, Sunrise Market, and M2M. And just this January, we launched a fresh ramen kit at Whole Foods Markets in New York City.
Mm, I tried it. It works.
Thank you.
Right. And do your clients come to you with a recipe or ask you to make your recipe, give them your recipe?
So I think, two parts. So we work with Ivan Ramen, and Ivan Orkin knows exactly what he wants.
Mm, so Ivan Orkin is, he started ramen shop in Japan, and he became a superstar in Japan. And
exactly.
He just opened, recently opened
in
his
New York
place.
City. Right? Yeah. So for someone like Ivan, who makes noodles in Japan and knows exactly what he wants, he'll come to us, and then we will look over what we can do, because the ingredients are completely different here with the flour, but we'll tweak it, and so that we'll work towards making a noodle that makes him happy. And there are a lot of chefs like Ivan who come over from Japan or who have this kind of idea of ramen noodle that they want, and then we'll tweak it together. But for the most part, we have over 100 different types of noodle doughs that customers can choose from.
Wow.
Yes.
So you have different machines, 100 different machines, or just change some parts and you can customize?
So the blend, we have 100 different types of blends of noodles, those, and then from there we can cut it like thin, thick, medium thick, wavy, or straight, and also the weight, 5 ounces, 6 ounces.
Interesting. So what is the difference between ramen noodles and other noodles, like, for example, like pasta?
I would say it comes down to the ingredients. I've learned that pasta is not just extruded, they also cut it. And so, but for ramen noodles, what's most important is what we call kanshi. And kanshi is alkaline salt that's a blend of sodium and potassium carbonate. And I believe only in ramen noodles is kanji used.
Mm.
And it, when you eat ramen noodles, you have this kind of aroma. It's an alkaline kind of smell.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from kanji. But it also plays an effect on the texture.
Mm.
So it makes the ramen noodles a little bit firmer. In texture.
Mm. So how does it work, like, chemically?
We bring in our kanji from Japan,
mm-hmm.
and it's in a powdered form.
Mm.
And we would blend this kanji with our water tank,
mm-hmm.
and then create the solution that we then mix with our flour.
Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I heard it's the flavonoid in the flour that turns to yellow with kanji. That's why the ramen noodles are yellow. That's what I heard.
I've heard that, you know, when I was growing up too, and so I've tried many times. I just put kanji, mm-hmm. water, and flour.
Yeah.
I don't think it turns as yellow as people probably think.
Okay.
It might turn a little bit gray, but a lot of the color that comes, a lot of the yellow color that comes for ramen noodles either comes from egg yolks or vitamin B2 or artificial coloring.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And so that kanji makes it chewier because I heard, I just did a little crazy research, but, you know, the gluten in the flour has a nature to dissolve into alkaline water, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the gluten in the water prevents the starch in the dough from expanding.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as a result, dough gets tighter and chewier. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds about right. It sounds very scientific. For us, naturally, when you mix wheat, flour, and water, mm-hmm. and only these two, when it comes together, it naturally develops this gluten.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I think when you add kanji, what we've tested is that gluten is very chewy, but when you add kanji, you get this firm, brittle texture.
Mm.
So it's, I think it's just a process of balancing it out.
Okay.
So firm and chewiness, and then that's how we balance our kanji.
Right.
What it does to the water is it increases the pH level above 7.2.
Okay.
So 7.2 is just natural,
mm-hmm.
and when we increase it, it makes it more alkaline.
Mm.
And so we use those ingredients to make our noodles.
Right. Yeah, I tasted your noodles many times, and then it's like a bouncing. They say chewy, but it's not like a chewing gum chewy. It's
kind of
bouncing back to your, you know, teeth, and it's comfortable, addictive texture. Okay, so what are the variations of noodles when customize them for your clients? In other words, you know, what are the variables that chefs are concerned about?
Let's see. From my experience and speaking to customers, we have one, I guess what we call a set of customers that have traveled to Japan.
Mm.
And let's say they went to Hokkaido or Tokyo or Kyushu. And they would want to replicate that regional style of ramen here in the States.
Because they're distinctive in style.
Exactly.
Right,
the miso, shoyu, and tonkotsu ramen, different styles.
Right.
When they come back to us with that, we already have some kind of idea of what noodle that they're looking for because of the different regional varieties.
Right.
On the flip side, there is customers who want to do completely different, maybe something that we've never heard of.
Mm.
And so from there, we would have to test and bring in different flours,
mm-hmm.
and blend it and craft a noodle that's a little bit different.
Right, so probably different thickness, like you said earlier, like chewiness, maybe the level of kansui, I don't know, or length and curliness, that kind of variation.
The common ones that we get is the length of the noodle, the thickness, and the weight.
Okay.
Yeah.
So weight means how dense the dough is?
No, so for example, if a ramen shop is making a regular size of bowl of ramen, it would be 5 ounces portion of noodles.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe this restaurant wants to do a small ramen, so they only want 3 ounces.
Okay.
And so they want to change that weight of the portion.
Hmm. Yeah. Interesting. So, for instance, you know, like tonkotsu, it's a pork bone soup.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of noodle do you suggest? What people prefer normally?
Yeah, so just traditional tonkotsu style noodles is It's a very low moisture noodle, so less water in the dough.
Okay.
And it's very white and very, very thin, like angel hair pasta. Mm. So it cooks quickly, but it also gets soggy quickly because there's no moisture.
Oh, okay. Because the soup is thick already. You don't need a thick noodle.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. And by the way, I spoke to one of the popular ramen companies in New York, and then they said the noodles are made thicker than those in Japan because people tend to talk more as they eat here. And whereas in Japan, people eat ramen as fast food. So they sit down and sometimes keep standing and eat and leave. So they have to customize it for
Yeah, that's interesting.
All right. So now let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Kenshiro's Ramen Lab. And so please stay with us.
The National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Kenshiro Oki, who is the general manager of San Noro in New Jersey, and also the co-founder of Ramen Lab in Narita. So you opened the Ramen Lab in January. What is it?
So Ramen Lab is our attempt to showcase to New York City the different styles of ramen available throughout the world, especially here in the U.S.
Wow. So it's a test kitchen, tasting room, that kind of?
Yeah. I mean, it's actually many things. So the concept is that we bring in a new or a ramen shop every month to showcase their style of ramen here in New York City.
Mm. It's like a smorgasbord of ramen.
Pretty much. and I think, you know, the goal is, one, is for the people who come to our shop to try a different style of ramen every month. Two, is that guest chef who may have a vision to open in New York City or in America one day to test out his or her skills in New York City. And then for us, ourselves and our operations department is to understand that there's different methods of thinking of approaching of making a bowl of ramen by each chef. So,
right. And then... I mean, you have like a 3-week pop-up every month? Right. Interesting. And what's on the menu? You know, you have regular menu when you have no pop-up?
No. So every 3 weeks, there's a new ramen shop that comes in. If there is any downtime, we use it more for seminars.
Okay.
Or we use it for sales training.
So seminars, it's for chefs or?
Chefs, yes. We've had the MOFAD, Museum of Food and Drink, come in. And we did a ramen flight seminar. We bring in other potential chefs who want to open up. Wow. And we give them a seminar. It's beautiful. We have a full kitchen. Everything that we need to make ramen in that tiny space.
Right. So whoever wants to take that seminar, how can they find information?
Right now, it's only industry, so they will contact our sales team or our distributors.
Right, so this is the San Noro website.
Yes, yes.
Okay, right. And by the way, you have a corporate chef who's Shige Nakamura, who is known as a ramen legend in Japan. So he works on different kinds of noodles.
Yeah, well, so we've worked for many years together. However, he... still helps us when we have customers who want to open up shops. But I think, you know, he has he has a shop in Japan as well, right, called Nakamura-ya. Mm-hmm. And, you know, right now it's best for him to go back. He hasn't been back for many years.
Okay.
And so he's back there right now, trying to regroup and organize what that Nakamura-ya is going to do in the future.
Right. So it sounds like Ramen Lab is really a global meeting point of ramen.
Which is very fortunate for us. You know,
So what about the pop-up menu? Do you have any set format or any free?
So we started off in January with a very, very traditional Tokyo shoyu ramen, which is what we call the chuka soba, very classic. And then from there we went towards Ichikoro. And they're opening in Tampa, Florida. And they do what we feel like is going to be the future, is they've taken what's locally available in Tampa and infuse it in ramen.
So sounds like seafood.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, they do a take on champon that's more or less using local ingredients. For example, their chashu was Cuban inspired spices.
Interesting.
So very interesting. Every month when you come in, it's completely different, and that's very exciting for us.
Right. And how do you select as the chef, guest chef?
So we have a group of chefs and people in the restaurant industry that we respect. And they are the ones that help us pick and choose. But there are some criteria that they need to fill. Does this ramen shop do something that represents where they come from? So whether they're from the U.S. or Japan, is it something that's very unique to where they come from? Is it something that's not available in New York City?
Okay.
Another one. And then a third is people who want to open a shop one day, have been maybe doing pop-ups in their city, and want to use this space as a place to really test it and have customers come in.
Okay. And, you know, the current, you know, pop-up chef, Nishioka, Chef Nishioka.
Yes.
I happen to know him. And then, yeah, on his Facebook page, I think a couple of weeks ago, he said that he decided to expand his business in other cities in the U.S. because he's based in Boston, right?
Yes.
So because he gained the confidence at the Ramen Lab.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so you are definitely doing something very meaningful to the ramen community.
Right. Thank you.
Right. So so could you please give us some examples of, you know, past pop-up chefs' great ramen?
You know, every ramen shop that came into Ramen Lab is already great. I think you've seen it through the lines that are out the door. But, you know, from the customer standpoint, that's really exciting for me is, let's say in the month of March, you really enjoyed this ramen. But there are others who maybe didn't care for it so much. But the following month, that same customer loved this ramen and then the other one didn't care for it that month. And so we've been trying to see that and you know, really showcase to people that there's likes and dislikes. And even for ramen, you know, there's so many different types of ramen out there that you'll appreciate some and you probably won't care for others. And at the end of the day, that's really great for us because we want to showcase to people that there's not just one style of ramen that maybe you've tried that once in your life, but there's a lot of ramen out there. And so we've had four or five chefs now at Ramen Lab.
Okay.
And they were all very, very different. And they're all very good.
Right. So what's the popular style?
I think right now it's still kind of the rich flavors. So like the tonkotsu or the tori paitan, which is like a chicken broth that's been cooked for many hours.
With bones.
Exactly.
So it's like a gelatinous.
Yeah. So that's something I learned from Ramen Nikko. When they came to Ramen Lab, the chef is from Shigaken, Japan, near Kyoto. But he sourced everything from the U.S. All the chicken, everything to make his tare was from the U.S., except this one equipment that he brought from Japan. And it's like this massive grinding blender thing. So as the chicken's cooking in the pot, he uses this thing and he like crushes the bones and just keeps on cooking it. And that's where he got his really rich chicken broth.
Mm.
And that was very interesting for people to see.
I'm curious where the machine is from. Is it Japanese or customized?
Yes.
Right. Okay, so you said American people here in New York City tend to like thicker, richer.
Yeah, that's what we've seen. But every time or whenever someone tends to appreciate the lighter broth, that really makes us excited because, in Japan, it seems like when you're younger, you eat the rich broth. And then as you tend to get older and age, you tend towards, to like the lighter broths.
Mm.
And that's great for us.
Yeah. Right, kind of. And also at the same time, you're observing customers growing and the palate is maturing.
Yeah. Right. If there's one common thing that we've seen is spicy. People are always requesting spicy. Yeah, so if any ramen shop out there wants to create a menu, spicy is something to think about. Yeah.
So like spicy rolls, the same thing with sushi.
Yeah, maybe. Exactly. Just like spicy ramen is very popular.
Yeah. Okay, so that's a good tip for ramen, the business who's considering opening ramen business here, right? Spicy, that's the keyword.
Yeah.
Right. So our listeners can buy your noodles at the Whole Foods in New York, right?
Yes.
So do you have any tips for cooking ramen noodles at home?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing, it's fresh noodles.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's completely different from instant ramen. For our noodles, we recommend that the cook uses a big pot of boiling hot water.
Like pasta,
right. Yes. It doesn't have to be salted, just hot water that's boiling. And, to cook noodles properly. For our noodles at Whole Foods, we recommend 1 minute and 30 seconds cook time. And sometimes if you overcook it, there's a trick to getting that texture back. It's just by shocking it in cold water, and it brings that texture right back.
Okay.
So, but yeah, I mean, for our noodles, it's just constantly using fresh boiling water.
Okay. And, I looked at your website, and then we highly discourage boiling both the noodles and the soup in the same pot.
Yes.
So what happens if you do?
What happens when you do? Our noodles are coated with cornstarch, and so if you cook the water and the noodles and the soup all together, you get this kind of slimy taste. It's not really pleasant. So, cooking the noodles in a separate pot, and then for the soup base, you can put it in your bowl and just add a cup of hot water. And then once the noodles are cooking, you strain it, put the noodles in, and then from there you can use any kind of vegetables, proteins, toppings that you can imagine.
Right. So rinse it and put it in the soup.
Yes.
That's the key.
Yes.
All right. By the way, in the home, it's hard to make tonkotsu soup, right? Because you have to re-cook the pork bones.
Yes.
So what's the recommendation for the ramen beginners at home?
To make tonkotsu or just any kind of
Any kind. I mean, tonkotsu, I think maybe you need a pressure cooker or something like that, right?
Well, if you're making it only for yourself, just get some pork knuckle bones. And since you're making it for yourself, it's just use a pot, a smaller pot, more bones, water, and then just keep on boiling it for a long time. You're not going to yield a lot of soup, which is the hardest part if you're making it for a party. But if it's just for yourself, I think it's a lot easier. But yeah, I think making any kind of broth and pairing that with the tare packets or the soup packets that are included in the ramen kits makes more of a tasty bowl.
Right. So tare is basically addition to the soup taste, right?
Yes.
To accentuate.
Exactly. We always say there's five elements to a great bowl of ramen. One is noodles. The second one is soup stock. That's unseasoned broth. That's cooked from bones, fish. The third is a tare, or the liquid seasoning. This is where you get the flavors of ramen, the umami. Aromatic oils, so like chicken fat, green onion oil. And then the fifth is just toppings. And if you can really balance out these five elements, you can craft a great bowl of ramen anywhere.
Wow. Tasty. Right. And I'm sure there are different kinds of styles of ramen. Like you said, early before the show we just talked, and then your next pop-up chef is going to be from Korea.
Yes.
Right? So they have different kind of ramen?
Yeah. His is a very heavy tonkotsu ramen. Mm-hmm. And he uses kimchi on the side for his ramen. And so I'm really excited to see what he does here.
Right.
But different styles and different ways of thinking of presenting your bowl.
So he's got the key. He's spicy.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Okay. And, it sounds like, it's the China, Korea, Japan, they have the origin of ramen already. But, it's becoming really, really popular. Sounds like worldwide.
Yes.
So how do you predict the future of ramen? Here in New York, of course, probably it's most close to saturation, right? Mm-hmm. All the chefs and the shops. But in the U.S., I think there are many restaurants, ramen shops in all over the country too, right?
Yes, yes. There's a lot opening in other parts, for example, like Chicago or Texas, the Pacific Northwest, such as Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington. The amount of ramen shops and inquiries that we get from these areas has grown tremendously. Mm. So,
are they mostly American chefs, ramen shops, or both?
Both, yeah. We have a few Japanese ramen shops coming over overseas, but a lot of people from the U.S. Interested in opening ramen shops.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's also more creative, and I think it's really good for ramen culture itself.
Yes.
It's more creative and innovative.
Yeah. So we, the authentic styles that you could see in Japan, I think that's a great first step for many of the ramen shops here. Mm. But, the future or what we are trying to achieve is what we call regionalized ramen. Mm. And so one day it's having a specific style of ramen from New York City or Texas or Seattle that kind of represents them from their city.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. So what the New York one would be?
I'm not sure. I'm sure out of the thousands of talented chefs that there will be something that represents New York in a bowl of ramen.
Right. Yeah. Maybe in 3 years, 5 years.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. And I heard you started to distribute in Europe too.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So that market is big there.
Okay. Yeah, we started to distribute in Europe 2 years ago. Mm. But this year has been tremendous in the amount of noodles that we send over to places like London or Paris or Switzerland.
So, wow. So then the local chefs started to open ramen shops?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
And do they have different styles of ramen than here?
Yes, yes, a lot. I think right now, especially in Paris and London, a lot of chefs and ramen shops opening up.
Mm. Yep. Do you know any interesting ramen that they have locally?
I've only been to London twice, but I've been fortunate to visit a place called Bone Daddy's, and it's opened by a local chef. But he uses like chicken skin and chops them up and uses that as toppings for this kind of crunchy texture. Mm-hmm. It's a ramen that I've never had anywhere else, and that was very exciting.
Wow, that's great. So it sounds like you get educated as much as you educate them.
I get educated more than I can offer anyone, but that's what's great. Every day you're learning something different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And do you sell noodles to Japan too?
No. My grandfather still has a factory in Tochigi, and they distribute products in that area. But not
okay.
In Japan.
Yeah, because I think it would be interesting if you have ramen lab in Tokyo or somewhere.
Okay. That'd be amazing.
Right.
We do sell our saimen. Mm-hmm. So saimen is a Hawaiian ramen dish in Japan.
Hmm.
Yes.
What's the difference?
Saimen, noodles, if you just be technical, it's a higher ash content flour, so it's a lot darker and grayer. Mm. But it's a very simple dashi from fish. Very, very simple that Hawaii people love to eat.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So what's your plan next?
We have a lot of things happening. I just got back from Hawaii because of our meeting, but a lot of product launches for the retail market.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to really target the retail consumers on making our products at home.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow. So more ramen that we can eat at home. Great. All right. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
For making great ramen noodles.
Thank you.
Listeners, if you'd like to know more about Sun Noodle and Ramen Lab, please visit sunnoodle.com and ramenlab.com. That is ramen-lab.com. And if you have any questions or comments, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And you can also reach me at akiko-katayama.com. Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org. Today's music was provided by RecTech. And next up, you'll hear a short clip of Chef Marco Canora sharing some snack hacks on the food scene. So I'll see you next week.
There's so much misinformation out there, and everybody thinks that eating well needs to be surrounded with deprivation. And it's like, it's not deprivation at all. Like, I'm a fucking hedonist.
Chef Marco Canora shares some snack hacks on episode 226 of The Food Scene, hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel.
I love food. I eat food like crazy. I don't need to be hungry to eat food. It is just like a huge part of my life. And, you know, a lot of people are afraid of this idea of eating well because they think that you turn your back on all that stuff. And no, it doesn't mean you turn your back on loving food. It just means you have to educate yourself and think differently about it.
So when you think of popcorn, do you instantly think, oh, that's fiber. That's going to clear me out.
I think about popcorn and then I say, well, let's make sure I put the right fat on it. And let's make sure, you know, I'm getting a good quality popcorn that's not some kind of highly mass-produced GMO popcorn. And then it's great popcorn, and I'll grate some really good pecorino cheese on it and put a boatload of black pepper on it and put a big hunk of really good grass-fed butter on it and some nice sea salt. And, man, it's fucking delicious, decadent popcorn that I could eat a tub of it until I'm sick. And I'm not going to feel so bad about it, right?
Because of you now kachu y pepeing something is like a verb in our house.
Right.
We always have that hunk of pecorino.
This was an excerpt from episode 226 of The Food Scene, hosted by Michael Harlan Turkel. Did you like it? The Food Scene episodes are available on our website or on iTunes. Dig in for more. This piece was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.